Good morning. Good morning. Welcome to Church Creek. So this is our sixth installment of our series on Christian worldview. And before we get started with the lesson, I would like to go ahead and open us with a prayer. So bow your heads with me as we go before the throne of grace. Our Heavenly Father, we come before you today and bless you, for you are holy and worthy of praise. We thank you for the gift of salvation in your Son. We ask that you teach us daily who we are in Christ and open our understanding to know the Scriptures and to learn better how to apply your word to our daily context. Strengthen our faith, lead us from faith to faith, and preserve us in your grace as we seek to live in this world. These things we pray in your Son's name. Amen. So this, again, is the sixth part of our 12-part series here. And last week, we discussed the notions of dignity and honor and emotivism, or expressive individualism, and the concept of a death work, or a form of art that is designed to subvert a given value. We also briefly touched on how a few key thinkers landed a pretty significant death blow to the classical understanding of human nature. And as we continue our study this week, we're going to look a little bit more closely at these figures, namely Friedrich Nietzsche, Karl Marx, and Charles Darwin, and how their ideas relate to our context today. Our narrative so far has centered around the redefining of the self in the Western world and how it shifted from an identity that was given by one's social surroundings to one that is self-defined or self-imagined. And Carl Truman calls this the plastic person, one who can, or thinks he can, remake himself at will. But this kind of thinking requires a metaphysical framework and a certain kind of society with a particular social imaginary in order to thrive. The idea that we can be whoever we want to be or whatever we want to be is pretty standard today and makes for the underpinnings of movies like Zootopia, where anyone can be anything, and video games like Cyberpunk 2077, where the unmodified human is nothing but cannon fodder for the enhanced. Books like Westworld or TV shows like Altered Carbon. It's pretty standard today. And consumerism kind of fuels this notion with the message that the consumer is king. The customer is always right. That's a pretty standard phrase today that you hear. And my product that I'm making will buy you this happiness that you've been seeking. This car, that phone, those shoes, that house, watch this movie, binge watch that TV show. These will transform you into the person that you want to be. And the consumer, being right all the time, reinforces the idea that you need not consider anything or anyone else. The dynamic undertone here is that your desires are never quite fully satisfied, at least not for any long term. Whatever you buy today needs to be replaced tomorrow. And if you've understood, if you've studied Aristotle at any length, you're probably familiar with his articulation of being and becoming, a constant steady state and a constant state of change. And G.W.F. Hegel applied this more keenly to our self-awareness and existence, where Aristotle was looking at the physical and metaphysical. Hegel looks at the personal self-awareness and applies this to persons in terms of their being or always chasing after that next purchase that will bring the elusive wholeness. But there remain limitations on our ability to reinvent ourselves. How much wealth we have, the ever-changing list of what society accepts or rejects or calls cool, and what goods are even available to purchase. These are limitations on how we can reinvent ourselves. Consumerism makes one believe that he or she can be whatever they want, but these limitations still exist. But that does not change the fact that the idea of self-creation, or the idea that we can reshape ourselves by sheer acts of will, are still so deeply embedded in our thinking that we can simply deny being who we presently are recognized to be. For example, I may not be able to physically be Lady Saigo, who was the wife of Tokugawa Ieyasu, one of the guy who unified Japan and ruled as shogun, paving the way for the Edo period in Japan. But I can still choose to deny my genetic makeup and alter my body to suit my imaginary. I often think of the Pixar movie WALL-E and the way that humans are depicted on board that spaceship. There's a scene where the AI notes, they're all in this big open area, and the AI notes that the new color of today is blue. And everybody looks up and goes, ooh, and they push a button on their data pad and all their clothes suddenly turn blue. But this kind of thinking requires not simply roots in ideology, but material support as well. For example, the Bhagavad Gita, an ancient text that was written in Sanskrit, estimated to be around 5,000 years old, has a saying in there that man is made by his beliefs. As he believes, so he is. It also says, make it easy for yourself. Get organized, live in the moment. Your day-to-day activities should not steal your happiness. And this sounds an awful lot like what we've been talking about and what we see today, but it wasn't until much later, this document is 5,000 years old, it wasn't until much later that this idea kind of found its way into becoming a practical reality. And this is where Friedrich Nietzsche, Karl Marx, and Charles Darwin come in. But we'll also have a look at their context and what brought them to the forefront, because this is where a key understanding is found. So Friedrich Nietzsche came along in the 19th century, and he challenged the Enlightenment thinkers who quite purposefully rendered the idea of God implausible and unnecessary. In his work, The Gay Science, in this sense the term gay is joyful or happy, he made the famous assertion that God is dead. He has a particular story about a madman that grips the imagination, but he also made another commentary, which we'll use his own words here, or at least the words of his translator. After Buddha was dead, his shadow was still shown for centuries in a cave, a tremendous, gruesome shadow. God is dead, but given the way of men, there may still be caves for thousands of years in which his shadow will be shown. And we will still have to vanquish his shadow too. So you see, Nietzsche isn't significant simply because he didn't believe in God. There were many people who didn't believe in God. And he didn't have any new ideas in this space. He's significant because he challenged the Enlightenment thinkers that they had started something that they didn't intend to finish. They made God unnecessary and implausible, but they never addressed the cultural foundations that were built on God's laws. He raised very pungent questions and challenges to science, logic, and morality, each of which needed to be reimagined in light of this new death of God. Science is no longer thinking God's thoughts after him, as Sir Isaac Newton once said, but it needed a new definition. Logic is no longer the right use of reason in the inquiry after truth, as stated by Isaac Watts. Morality was no longer something grounded in the character of God, or even that it has an intrinsic purpose. In particular, he attacks the notion that the universe, considered in itself, can have any intrinsic meaning at all. Knowledge, for Nietzsche, is nothing more than giving some kind of authority to ideas that have proven useful in the past. Or have some longevity and general acceptance, but are really rooted in instinct and struggles for power. Morality, for him, is dismissed as being nothing more than herd instinct in the individual. And this is similar to Rousseau's notion of the authentic person being the one who is least socialized and civilized, that your true self is corrupted by society. For Nietzsche, the Enlightenment thinkers removed the foundation for the existence of God, making him nothing more than a crutch or a prop to support their moral norms. But this is not to be done without taking on the responsibility of recreating the world on which that was built. The lighthearted atheism of Richard Dawkins is not for Nietzsche. He fails to see the radical consequences of rejecting God. And this is the point at which he strikes hard. The hope that something like evolution might make us moral, or that something is inherently good, requires some notion of a transcendent anchor, an anchor that that gives you your starting point. And this is what was ripped out by the Enlightenment thinkers, but not replaced. These implications for the death of God are ultimately what drives Nietzsche in his polemic against Christianity in particular. He didn't limit his polemic to Christianity, but also to other thinkers like Immanuel Kant, where he renders arguments useless as just being another God word. For Nietzsche, he demands that Christians ultimately acknowledge that their claims for objective truth aren't actually truth, but claims about how they want the world to be in order to suit their own ends. Now, he was particularly bothered by the idea of favoring weakness over strength. And strength, as strength was nature's true virtue, and Christians try to subvert this in his mind. This changes the discussion of morality, shifting it from a matter of discovering virtue or eternal laws into an analysis of psychology. So what is right and wrong is no longer an objective truth, but a psychological matter to be analyzed. The question for him then moves to, from is this good or bad, to why do people act this way? To use his own words here, let us articulate this new demand. We need a critique of moral values. The value of these values themselves must be called in question. And for that, there is needed a knowledge of the conditions and circumstances in which they grew, under which they evolved and changed, morality as consequence, as symptom, as a mask, as tartuffery, as illness, as misunderstanding, but also as a cause, as a remedy, as a stimulant, and as a restraint, as a poison. A knowledge of a kind that has never yet existed or even been desired. So to put this simply, he did not advance a new theory against older theories, but he proposed the abandonment of theory altogether. Someone like David Hume, a Scottish Enlightenment philosopher and historian, challenged and dismantled Christianity by analyzing how human beings know things. As we look back to our first couple of lessons, there is a Christian view of knowledge. How do we come to knowledge? Are there limits to our knowledge? And David Hume challenged that. And Hume would laugh at the claims of Christianity and consider Christians to be dim-witted. But Nietzsche, he dismantles Christianity by questioning the motives that lie behind it. And he's nauseated by the idea of Christianity. He finds it repulsive. And there are two aspects of Nietzsche that we see enjoying philosophical prominence today. One is the tendency to be suspicious of any claims for absolute truth, absolute moral truth. And the other is a rejection of religion as distasteful and socially harmful. At root, his attacks against Christian morality and metaphysics are really attacks against the classical view of human nature. And again, we'll use his own words here. Man has been educated by his errors. First, he always saw himself only incompletely. Second, he endowed himself with fictitious attributes. Third, he placed himself on a false order of rank in relation to animals and nature. Fourth, he intervened ever new tables of goods, or he invented ever new tables of goods, and always accepted them for a time as eternal and unconditional. A result of this, Now one and now another human impulse and state held first place and was emboldened, and was ennobled because it was esteemed so highly. If we removed the effects of these four errors, we should also remove humanity, humaneness, and human dignity. In short, we have given ourselves a special place in nature and tied ourselves to a moral code that is prohibitive of our true potential. Humanity needs to be freed from a transcendent moral code and from a limiting sense of dignity in order to recreate ourselves. He goes on to articulate that one thing is needful, that a human being should attain satisfaction within himself, whether it be by means of this or that poetry and art. This really sets the tone and establishes the modern trope of be whoever you want to be, and be whatever works for you. Now, Karl Marx comes into our story a little bit earlier chronologically than Nietzsche, but the ideological impact comes a little bit later. We noted Hegel a few times in this series, and for Hegel, history moves forward as an intellectual struggle between ideas in the self-conscious. Marx, a Hegelian earlier in his years, eventually breaks from that and argues that it's not ideas that drive historical process, but rather it is the material conditions and relations. In other words, Hegel would be flipped upside down. Ideas don't shape the material conditions of the world, but the material conditions of the world shape the ideas and the self-conscious. He was acutely aware of how the Industrial Revolution and production and capitalism it represented were overturning traditional social structures and remaking society. The classes were far less significant when a business could be started and wealth produced outside of the old class structures. Social relations are dependent more on economic relations, meaning that it didn't depend on your state of birth, but whether you could attain wealth through capital means. And he saw this and other effects being inherently political. One obvious example of this is religion. Marx is well known for his statement that religion is the opium of the people, which basically means that it's a way of keeping people passive with false happiness. And Friedrich Engels, in his work, The Peasant War in Germany, he interprets the Peasant War of 1525 in terms of both religion's disruptive and revolutionary potential and its social conservatism. He comments on Martin Luther's abandonment of the peasants and his use of the Bible to justify it, saying that he turned the Bible against them, extracting from it a real hymn to God-ordained authorities, such as no bootlicker or absolute monarchy had ever been able to achieve. But there's more to Marx's view on religion than that it simply is a tool for oppression. In context, here are his own words. The foundation of irreligious criticism is, man makes religion. Religion does not make man. Religion is indeed the self-conscious and self-esteem, self-consciousness and self-esteem of a man who has either not yet won through to himself or has already lost himself again. The struggle against religion is therefore indirectly a struggle against the world whose spiritual aroma is religion. Religious suffering is at one and the same time the expression of real suffering and a protest against real suffering. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of the heartless world, and the soul of soulless conditions. It is the opium of the people, the abolition of religion as the illusory happiness of people is the demand for their real happiness. That is a very long way of saying that religion is fairly useless, but he seems to be somewhat more sympathetic to religion than Nietzsche. And certainly it's more than what a quote out of context would allow.
Here, I have a question.
Yes.
So when it
Yes. So for Marx, so the question is whether he's talking about religion overall or whether he's talking about Christianity in particular. And he is specifically talking about religion overall. The most prominent religion in his context happened to be Christianity, but he was addressing all religion in general. He sees religion as being a mental crutch, projecting our ideal perfection onto a fictitious being who is then worshipped. If humans are to be truly happy, then they need to redirect that glory to themselves. And he builds this on Ludwig Feuerbach's criticism of religion, where he says, wherever morality is based on theology, wherever the right is made depending on divine authority, the most immoral, unjust, infamous things can be justified and established. I can found morality on theology only when I myself have already defined the divine being by means of morality. To place anything on God or derive anything from God is nothing more than to withdraw it from the test of reason, to institute it as indubitable, unassailable, sacred, without rendering any account of why. Hence, self-delusion, if not wicked, insidious design, is at the root of all efforts to establish morality right on authority.
Question.
Yes. Well, it was a slow progression, and today we see it being very prominent, especially in the West. Right? There are different issues that you face in Eastern countries, but in the Western philosophy in particular, the idea of God being a mental crutch, or something that we create for our own self-comfort, is pretty prominent. Well, this guy was German, so he wouldn't have been subject to the church in Rome at this point. Sure, yes, but this is well after the Reformation, and we'll bring the Reformation into this context as well, because these guys are not speaking in a vacuum. They're not writing in a vacuum, and as you know, technology progressed and you had the printing press, these writings could now go to far greater audiences than ever before. So what used to be the academic discussions that would more often than not be swept under the rug, they're now in the commonplace hands of people. So, like Nietzsche after him, Feuerbach sees God as an illusory foundation for morals, built on the foundation of malice, or at best, a delusion. Religion offers false happiness to an unhappy world. Tearing down religion is thus a precondition for true happiness. For these men, religion was not a matter of metaphysical interest. It wasn't a matter of what happens when we die. It was a question of illusion and malice, and poses other questions regarding human psychology. And while Marx himself doesn't seem to be entirely anti-essentialist in his thinking, later followers had less interest in describing man's nature, or human nature, in terms of essence, and more as pure functions of the wider social and economic structures of society, meaning that human nature isn't something that you are, it is a matter of how you interact with the society at large. For Marx, observing the Industrial Revolution, it seems that industrial capitalism tore apart and remade society, and with it, it revolutionized the world using technology. So human beings found themselves and their identities caught up in these technological changes. To make this more clear, again, we'll use his own words. The less skill and exertion of strength implied in manual labor, in other words, the more modern industry becomes developed, the more the labor of men is superseded by that of women. Differences of age and sex have no longer any distinctive social validity for the working class. All are instruments of labor, more or less expensive to use according to their age and sex. Now, I don't think that Karl Marx could have seen or understood the extent to which this would become true. We see the beginnings of this in the first wave of feminism in the wake of World War I, where the fact that women had done vital wartime work in the munitions factories, dramatically strengthening the case for granting the right to vote and change the subsequent dynamics in the workplace. Today you can find multimillionaire children under the age of 15 who invested in Bitcoin at the right time. You have 12-year-old business owners who started programming as soon as they could understand speech and wrote apps that are now worth billions. Technology has also played a key role in the more radical context of making plausible the separation of biological sex and the concept of gender. This separation is now basic to much of our social imaginary and rests on the notion that the self that emerged in the 17th and 18th, of the self that emerged in the 17th and 18th centuries. Marx wasn't thinking in terms of this kind of change, but just the change in production. But with modern surgery and medical breakthroughs, we can now plausibly separate gender from sex and even revise the relationship of the sexes to the means of reproduction. Where Nietzsche drew genealogy of morals through a psychological path, Marx drew a genealogy through a material thread. Now, the third figure that was impactful and landed a critical blow to our classical understanding of human nature and morality is none other than Charles Darwin, probably one of the more famous names that we know today. Both Nietzsche and Marx were familiar with Darwin, and both appreciated him for the theories that struck at the heart of traditional religion and metaphysics in favor of atheistic materialism. Nietzsche rejected human nature as being manipulative and a metaphysical trick. Marx redefined it as an ongoing social historical process, and Darwin provided an account that allowed for no special significance. Darwin was by no means the first to advocate for evolution. There were many before him. Nearly a century prior, Jean-Baptiste Lamarck argued for evolution of species via the inheritance of adaptations caused by environmental factors. But every theory provided up to this point had some form of a creator present that guided the process. Frances Ayala sums it up nicely when she says, "It was Darwin's greatest accomplishment to show that the complex organization and functionality of living beings can be explained as a result of natural process or natural selection without any need to resort to a creator, or an external agent. The origin and adaptations of organisms in their profusion and wondrous variations are thus brought into the realm of science." In other words, Darwin's theory of natural selection effectively made any metaphysical or theological claim concerning the origin of life irrelevant. One could, if one wished, believe that a divine hand guided the process, but the process itself could be adequately explained without the need of any such supernatural hypothesis. One could argue that the odds of natural selection developing in the way that we see the world today are 1 billion to 1. And we've heard that argumentation, but the Darwinian would simply respond that the internal rationality of the process of natural selection dramatically attenuates such odds. The question is not so much about the statistical likelihood of this happening, but rather how the world has come to be. And here is the genius of Darwin's approach. The world as we know it does not need a designer or a divine architect. It can be explained without any reference to the transcendent. It is an immanent process involving variations and adaptations over vast periods of time. Now, I'm being pretty brief on my treatment of Darwin, but it's the intuitive simplicity of his theory that made him so influential. The science is far more complex than Darwin imagined in his day, but the basic idea is very easy to grasp. And it's come to shape the way that many people think who aren't able to really assess the scientific evidence. Darwin is far less hostile than Marx and Nietzsche, but nevertheless strips the world of any intrinsic meaning and purpose. More recently, scientific writers like Bill Nye and Richard Dawkins have made scientific assertions more accessible. And following the Scopes monkey trials in 1925, the claims of religious thinkers have all but lost credibility. But each of these three entered the scene in the early 19th century. There's something very much present in their own context that we often lose sight of. We often study philosophers in isolation with their works, their ideas, and who they directly interacted with, and they refer to each other from time to time. But they lived in a world that was still teeming with the backlash of the reformations in England, France, Germany, and all throughout Europe. Nation-states were free from Roman Catholic Church, only to be replaced by another religious institution that wasn't always better. The American Revolution, the French Revolution, the Salem witch trials in the Americas, these were fresh events with strong religious undertones, if not overt religious themes. The church was debunked as having a credible knowledge of science when they went to task with Copernicus over whether the sun was the center of the universe, and when the debacle with Galileo over the spherical nature of the earth. Coming out of the Reformation and systematic theologies that articulated the attributes of God from a logical standpoint, the Enlightenment era challenged the idea of knowledge without evidence. For pre-modern thinkers like Aquinas and Calvin, God's transcendence did not make him less immanent. We learned a few weeks ago that God is both transcendent and immanent. But this became less of an accepted position. Amos Funkenstein, in his work, Theology and the Scientific Imagination, identifies two ways that modern thinkers began to worry about God's location. The first is that many forces in culture were moving language toward greater univocity, meaning that words have only one meaning, or specifically, using language that applies to the properties of God that mean the same thing when the word is applied to other things. And second, people were beginning to think of space as more homogeneous, not as a hierarchy of heaven and earth, where one has greater honor than the other, but as a geometric space where everything has the same status. And these two factors reinforced each other. For medieval man, the natural world was full of multiple meanings. During the Renaissance as well, Ian Hacking noted, there were signs, real signs, written by God on nature. People spoke with signs, but so did the world around us. Modern thinkers look at this as being metaphorical flourishes, but to the medieval world, this was part of the fabric of nature. But now, these questions began to arise. Where is God, and what is he doing? It wasn't long before deists and creationists like Thomas Woolston, in the 18th century, began dismissing the idea of miracles. He presented the basic question, granting God as the first cause, does God ever intervene once things have started off? Woolston was too outrageous for his day, but his opponents granted him the terms of his debate. They allowed the question. Not too long before this, most theologians would have dismissed the question at all. This question would change the shape of scientific inquiry, even among theistic scientists. Isaac Newton, who famously said that science is thinking God's thoughts after him, also asserted that the universe was a sort of sensorium, or an organ, whereby God sensed things. This question of where is God and does he do anything began to reshape the thinking of everyone of that day. Space is to God what our sensory field is to a human mind. This had significant impact on Einstein's theory of relativity centuries later. He had a prolonged debate with Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz over the matter and revised his statement to avoid the charge that God depended on his creation. But he nevertheless argued for what seemed to Leibniz to make God the soul of the world. Newton saw in his theory of gravitation that God periodically intervenes to correct his creation, adjusting things where necessary. Leibniz had his own problems as well. He wrote in a letter to a friend that God is everything. Creatures are some things. Newton was a profoundly influential thinker, and this debate with Leibniz set the stage for subtly domesticating God's transcendence. God could be thought of in terms of his direct correspondence to his creation, and not something outside of his creation. Now, Newton and Leibniz effectively remove the personal nature of God. Nietzsche makes God a psychological crutch. Marx makes him a social weapon. Darwin makes God unnecessary altogether. What this has led to is the common understanding among astrophysicists today that the universe is self-creating and self-correcting. Physicists like Stephen Hawking can assert that because we have the law of gravity, the universe can and will self-create. Noam Leibniz observes that the universe is always spinning. He says not only are the galaxies spinning, but also the stars within the galaxies, and the Earth is spinning, and the moon is spinning around the Earth. Pretty much the whole universe is spinning. Down to the atom, everything spins. Now, British scientist Steve Grand calls this the feedback, and he asserts that feedback is what has been missing from the science of Newton. We thought it was a rare phenomenon, but now it's hard to name anything in the universe that isn't feedback. Life itself turns out to be feedback. So essentially, the universe is a self-aware, self-creating, self-correcting system with everything else as its internal feedback loop. And this is the up-and-coming philosophy of looking at the data. Theologians have given up their ground centuries ago, and we stripped God of his transcendence. In effect, we've removed God from his being and have turned his handiwork into an analysis of self-creating and self-correcting. As Christians stand before the world, we don't often recognize that the narrative has shifted. And we can be too quick to dismiss or ignore completely any scientific data that is out there. In 1964, two radio astronomers working at Bell Labs, Robert Wilson and Arno Penzias, accidentally discovered cosmic microwave background radiation when they were attempting to map out frequencies emitting from the Milky Way galaxy. Over the next decade, this would be the basis of what is called the universe's explosive birth, or the Big Bang Theory. In 1978, they were given the Nobel Prize for what would be called the greatest scientific discovery of the 20th century. Prior to this, the scientific consensus was that the universe rested in a steady state. It always existed, was always present, and this discovery unseated the scientific consensus. And I think there are two general extremes that we see in culture today regarding science. One is that science explains everything and you can't challenge it. The other is that science is a big conspiracy. And we even hear sometimes that the accusation that if you disagree, you're a science denier. But the scientific debate is actually carried out in the public sphere through journal publications where a set of testable, falsifiable assertions are made. If the test can be verified, that is one step of the process. If they cannot be falsified, then it is considered valid. And the whole process of scientific discovery is, by its very nature, science denying to begin with. The goal is to disprove a given theory. But this is done not by asking questions like, well, what about genetic entropy, but by producing another set of testable, falsifiable facts. And this brings us back to our first 3 weeks, where we define the specific content of Christian worldview. The Christian is called to love the Lord our God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength. God's word is truth. It is not simply true, it is truth. The evidence of a Big Bang seems very much to be in harmony with the assertion that there was a beginning in which God acted. The Christian does not deny knowledge, but has specific understanding that all truth is God's truth, and all knowledge is rooted in God. Observing God's hand in creation is amazing, and seeing how he upholds the universe doesn't make our dismissal of him meaningful. It is in him that we live and move and have our being. So this brings us to a close today, and we don't have a whole lot of time for questions, but do we have any comments, questions? Yes.
Yes.